Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Sod 1 of For the Record program number 644, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This program is being recorded on August 10th of the year 2008. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Ed Haslam, the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, the book that'll be the focal point of the broadcast. Ed, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
It's been a while since we visited, and I guess we had one interview in which you shared the spotlight with Daniel Hompsicker. That was back in November of, I believe, actually 2006, when Dr. Mary's Monkey first came out. Oh, I should say that Dr. Mary's Monkey is published by Trine Day Publishing. And what I'd like to do, Ed, would be to stretch out here and give people something of a synoptic overview of the book. Veteran listeners to the program have heard about a previous and overlapping volume, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. This book supplements that with a number of important points of discussion. But let's start out, Ed. A lot of people have wondered, as did I when I first began studying the assassination of President Kennedy, an event through which the main topics of your book winds. I wondered, why New Orleans? Why was all this stuff going on in New Orleans? Why would some of the powerful elements that murdered the President of the United States be concentrated in New Orleans? And that is not a matter of caprice, nor is some of the biological research and biowarfare research elements that you've been researching. Tell us about New Orleans, and tell us about its political and economic history.
And what do you want to do in the second hour? There's so much you can say about New Orleans. The first part is New Orleans is the mouth of the Mississippi River, which is the largest commercial waterway in the United States, and therefore the commerce from all up and down the Mississippi River Valley, from Cincinnati and St. Louis and up to Minneapolis, and that all flows down through New Orleans. And so, you know, coal and machinery and all that stuff goes overseas, and bananas and all kinds of food and petroleum comes back into New Orleans. New Orleans is a huge commercial center. Secondly, in the 1960s, New Orleans had one of the most powerful congressional groups in the country. They were very good at reelecting people, so the seniority system gave Louisiana an immense amount of power. And thirdly, with the trade, a lot of that trade was with Cuba and Latin America. And when Castro took over Cuba in, I think it was January of 1959 or maybe January 1960, that was seen as, well, first of all, it immediately caused major problems with trade in New Orleans, and New Orleans lost about 25% of their Latin trade because of Cuba. But the possibility that the revolution might spread to the rest of Latin America threatened even more of their trade. So New Orleans had a real keen economic interest in the whole issue of Latin America because of the trade, and they had amazingly powerful politicians. If you've seen the JFK movie, they Garrison spends a certain amount of time on Lafayette Square there, and he points, he says, there's the CIA and there's the FBI. And what he doesn't bother to point out is that building right behind him, in that building was people like F. Edward Hebert, who was the chairman of the House Armed Services Appropriations Committee, okay? I mean, the entire budget of the U.S. military started on his desk. Also in that same building was Edwin Willis, who was the chair of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And you had that kind of political power centered right there in New Orleans. And, of course, one of the things Hebert was very famous at doing was hiding the CIA's budget in the military budget, so that people couldn't figure out what the CIA was really up to. And therefore, you have a very natural alliance between the covert mechanisms in the American government and New Orleans happening just naturally.
And another member of the Louisiana congressional delegation was a member of the Warren Commission. That was the late Representative Hale Boggs, the father of Cokie Roberts, the ABC News correspondent.
The NPR news correspondent.
NPR. Now, I guess she started out with ABC. Now she's
started
NPR.
Started out with CBS, actually.
Was it CBS?
In Italy. She got an appointment to, in Italy, CBS, yeah. But she's now famous as being the NPR political analyst.
New Orleans also is the site of a university which figures prominently in the story of Dr. Mary's Monkey, a very important university, one that does not have the public cachet of, say, the Ivy League schools, and yet is a really important element in scientific and academic research, and that is Tulane University. Tell us about Tulane, what it's noted for, and how it figures in this story to an extent.
Well, the whole history of Tulane was based on New Orleans's trade with Latin America, and one of the things that was happening was diseases like yellow fever and malaria were coming into New Orleans and the United States from Latin America. But the contact point was New Orleans. And as early as about 1837, they had major yellow fever epidemics there. One of the things about the Battle of New Orleans, which happened, you know, in 1814 and all that stuff, was... the Americans killed 5,000 British soldiers on the field that day, and 2 days later, the Americans lost 5,000 soldiers due to malaria. And malaria, by the way, has killed more American soldiers than gunshots have, okay? And so New Orleans has a long history of battling tropical diseases, and I think it was the yellow fever epidemic at the time in the 1830s or so. Was severe enough that they organized a bunch of doctors together, and they had to teach other people to be doctors because they didn't have enough doctors to fight the epidemic. And that is how Tulane Medical School got created. And it was actually, it was called the University of Louisiana at the time, and then later Paul Tulane donated some money to it. He was a guy from Baltimore originally, and had come down to New Orleans and made a fortune down there trading with Latin America. And today, so what I'm saying here is the whole history of Tulane Medical School with the battle with malaria and all that stuff is central to their relationship with Latin America and the trading community. And, of course, today they're the host institution of the Delta Regional Primate Center, which brings monkeys into the conversation.
Another important figure overlapping New Orleans power politics and also Tulane University, and a major figure in American medicine and reactionary politics, is Dr. Alton Ochsner. Tell us about Ochsner.
Well, Dr. Ochsner was from the Midwest originally, and his uncle was a very famous surgeon up in Chicago who founded the American College of Surgeons, and he was... had a lot of political clout coming into the situation, and he worked at his uncle's hospital up there, and his uncle had the Austrian physician who was visiting and had a theory on blood typing that the European doctors were not willing to listen to, and taught Alton Ochsner this theory on blood typing. And then Ochsner goes over to Switzerland, and he winds up being the person that actually brings blood typing to Switzerland, and you think of, you know, the Red Cross and the Swiss Blood Bank and everything else. I mean, it's a pretty major accomplishment. And when he comes back to the United States, he gets this appointment as chief of surgery at Tulane Medical School, and he's only maybe 31 at the time, maybe 29, something like that. And so he has a prestigious situation, and he winds up in a spat with Louisiana Governor Huey Long. And Huey Long throws him out of Charity Hospital, and so he spends his time doing things with associations because he can't go in the hospital, and he winds up becoming the president of the American Cancer Society. And then he starts his own clinic, which is a huge clinic today. I mean, it was modeled on the Mayo Clinic, and it's just about as big as the Mayo Clinic is. And that's the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans. And so that's the medical side of his life, but all throughout that time, he was doing covert assignments for the U.S. military. He worked for a while with the Marines and a while for the Navy and a while with the Air Force, and then he starts working with the FBI and the U.S. Public Health Service and presumably the CIA, and he winds up as being part of the intelligence community, the medical side of it, and then he winds up in the middle of the JFK thing because he's the guy that puts together the radio debates where Lee Oswald participates. And I say that because I got the phonograph album here with his picture on the back claiming credit for doing it. Okay, and so you wind up with this very peculiar situation where the guy that was the head of the American Cancer Society is somehow involved with Lee Oswald in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. And, oh, the footnote I forgot to tell you, Ochsner was also involved in the development and release of the polio vaccine, in fact, a stockholder in Qatar Laboratories. And so when the initial Salk vaccine was released and backfired, which is a fact that most people don't know about today, but Salk's got some really great PR people out there that keeps his image polished. Ochsner was in the middle of all that. In fact, there was a dispute that erupted on whether the vaccine was safe or not, and Ochsner was so convinced that it was safe, he called all the doctors at Tulane Medical School together in the big auditorium and publicly inoculated his grandchildren with the vaccine that did, in fact, turn out to be faulty, and he wound up killing his grandson in the process.
Veteran listeners to the program, or regular listeners, have recently heard a rebroadcast of that WDSU radio interview with Ed Butler and conversation carte blanche. I did an interview recently with Paris Flamand, who wrote the book The Kennedy Conspiracy, and that's a summation of the Garrison investigation in which he participated to an extent. And so that has recently been rebroadcast on these airwaves and can be accessed via internet on WFMU. Incidentally, Ed, a very quick interjection. In the late summer of 1963, the aforementioned Paris Flamand was the producer of the Long John Nebel Show, one of the seminal late-night radio talk shows. And in the late summer, they got a call from Lee Harvey Oswald, of all people, asking to be on the Long John Nebel Show in order to publicize his situation. So Oswald was doing more than just WDSU in the interview that Alton Ochsner basically arranged with Inca. Very quickly, Ed.
Dave, that's very interesting to me because the witness that I bring forward in Dr. Mary's Monkey has claimed that the WDSU radio interviews were Lee's idea in the first place. And he went to Ochsner with the idea because Ochsner was close to the people that owned WDSU and WDSU television, or of course the camera crews came out and filmed him passing out the leaflets. And the fact that you have a second person who says in the media that says Oswald contacted them wanting to be on the air, I think lines up very nicely with that. I think that's an important contribution.
I think it was, for the record, 6:21. In any event, certainly listeners can go to www.wfmu.org/Dave Emory, one word, DaveEmory. I did a number of interviews with Paris Flamand late last year and early this year, and I think that's 6:21. It might be 6:20. But maybe even 6:19, but it's right around there. And, Ed, you can listen to the program. It's available on Streaming Real Audio. So,
I'll check it out. It's a nice find.
It is. And very quickly, you know, it's interesting, too, how some of these historical trends wind forward, because you had a little encounter with Inca yourself, or the residua of Inca, when the Iran-Contra affair was gathering momentum in the early 1980s. I don't know if you think we'll have time to go into that, but that's just fascinating.
Well, I'll give you the one-liner on it. Ed Butler personally offered to show me Guy Bannister's files in the Inca offices. How's that?
That is fascinating. Guy Bannister, of course, former FBI agent, apparent intelligence, CIA and or military intelligence asset involved with the anti-Castro covert operations of which Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry, about whom we'll hear more in a minute, were a part. Something else I noted, too, in a program I did back in 1985, Arnold Ochsner, Alton Ochsner's son, And none other than David Duke, the former head of the Ku Klux Klan, or the former Ku Klux Klan leader, were involved in raising money for the Contras together in this same time period. So it's an interesting group of folks. Ed, you were talking about Altenauschner, you were talking about the polio vaccine. And in analyzing Mary's monkey, bearing in mind New Orleans, its geographical and geopolitical position as the gateway to the Mississippi River, the largest commercial waterway in the U.S., and also the northernmost port in the Caribbean, thereby making it something of a pivot point between the industrial giant United States and one of its huge markets, and some would say colonial territories, up to a point anyway, down in Latin America. The monkey tropical disease primate consideration overlaps the polio vaccine, and you talk a lot about monkeys and about monkey viruses. Tell us about the SV40 and how that begins to how that comprises something of a foundational element of the story we're covering here.
Well, the background note on the polio vaccine is that they grew the polio vaccine on monkey kidney cells, and after they had released 100 million doses of it, they discovered that one of the viruses in the vaccine produced cancer. So the realization that they had already mass inoculated the children of the American population with a cancer-causing virus was a huge mistake, a huge discovery for them with almost incalculable political consequences and financial consequences. So they went into, and the virus in question is the SV40 you referred to. And if anybody wants to know more about that, just Google SV40, you'll find it. And so what happened when they came to that realization, this is about 1959, they did two things. First of all, they declared the subject to be secret on the grounds of national security because they didn't care to have the political fallout from it. And secondly, they got really busy on trying to find a solution. And they were in a desperate situation, and because there were people in there that were quite happy to tell the public about it, and they wanted to have a solution in hand before the public found out about it. So they were trying to develop a vaccine against the SV40, the cancer-causing virus, in the polio vaccine. What is tricky about this is there were lots of monkey viruses in the polio vaccine. The fact that SV40 was named SV40 is to remind you that they had already found 39 other monkey viruses.
SV being an abbreviation for simian virus.
Right. And simian being the scientific term for monkey. So, you know, you have a situation there that you have just about the worst possible situation you can have with the highest stakes. I mean, this is like worse than war. You know, I promise you, the cancer epidemic we are experiencing today in the United States has killed more Americans than have ever been lost in all of the wars we have fought together. I mean, in fact, practically the annual numbers are that high, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So from a national security point of view, finding a solution to this was a major effort. It was every bit as important, frankly, as coming up with the atomic bomb, you know. And so they started a medical Manhattan project where they were given all the resources they needed in order to try to come up with a solution in time. And this was done, in my opinion, in New Orleans at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital starting in about 1960, and they assembled a top-tier team of the top scientists in the country who had the skills to conduct this operation. And, you know, one of the people that I believe to be on the team was Dr. Jose Rivera, who was from the Army Bioweapons Program and shows up as a character, person of interest, as they like to say, in the Kennedy assassination as well.
We'll talk about Rivera in just a second. We'll have to see how much we were able to cover in this interview, Ed. But one of the things that I found revelatory in your book was that and maybe that's just due to my ignorance, but that the simian immunodeficiency virus, which is closely related to the AIDS virus, was also among the viral contaminants of the polio vaccine. And one of the things that you talk about, and we'll sort of maintain the main focus from a disease standpoint on the soft tissue cancer epidemic that is unfolding now in the United States, but you also talk about the concatenation that we're discussing here in connection with AIDS and the development of AIDS as a possible BW weapon, too. We'll see if we have time to include all that.
Let me address your point about having time to cover. This book is a 375-page book.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And everybody who reads it just is startled by the amount of information on each and every one of those pages, okay? So it is impossible for us to cover the entire book in any depth in a one-hour radio interview. But what we can do is to give you an idea of the kind of information that's in there, you, the listeners, so that you can go find it out yourself, because I documented everything I put in the book. And even the footnotes are on my website, themonkeyvirus.com, so you can, they're in PDF, so you can enlarge them and read them more easily. But all the documentation is there. Now, about the AIDS issue, if you buy the mainstream scientific contention that AIDS is a mutation of a monkey virus, and I find that to be a reasonable assumption, and the scientific community says it is a mutation of SIV, the simian immunodeficiency virus, though there's a lot of games they're playing now with whether this came from African green monkeys or chimpanzees or whatever, and that's another subject we can talk about later. But the fact that these people were exposing these monkey viruses to radiation from a linear particle accelerator and doing that may have actually provided the opportunity for the SIV to mutate into HIV is a scientifically plausible and explanation of where AIDS may have come from. And I present the list of the other theories that are out there, and I find it to be as plausible and reasonable as any of the other theories, and it needs to be on the list.
And again, we've talked about AIDS and the iatrogenic nature of AIDS, namely a man-made disease, in numerous other programs, including programs involving you and some other authors and medical authorities. But we'll see if we have time to really get into that. But the title of your book is Dr. Mary's Monkey. What I'd like to do, Ed, and we've got about 6 or 7 minutes on this side, this half hour of the broadcast. One of the things that you talk about in your book are some remarkable women who have been involved in medical research in this country, really important medical research, and they were doing that at a time when for a woman to advance in professional fields of any kind was not easy. I've thought many times, Ed, that your book, some of the research in your book should be a focal point of serious feminist research. Tell us briefly about Sarah Stewart, Bernice Eddy, the polyoma, what they had discovered, and then let's move to the topic of Dr. Mary Sherman, at least as much as we can on this side, and we'll pick up the ball and run with it on side two.
Well, I agree with your analysis on that, Dave, and I recently had to speak in front of a women's business group, and the title of my speech was Six Remarkable Women from Dr. Mary's Monkey, and I just went down the list. Bernice Eddy started off running a laboratory in a leper colony, and she wound up being the chief vaccine safety tester for the United States government, and she tried to stop the release of the faulty polio vaccine in 1955, and they were ungrateful to her for doing that, and she's the one who finally blew the whistle on the contamination of the polio, of the cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. Her research partner, Sarah Stewart, MD, PhD, as Bernice Eddy had been, came to the National Institutes of Health with the idea that viruses could cause cancer, and she was not welcome there, and she fought very hard, and finally, with the help of Bernice Eddy, was able to prove in 1957 that, in fact, viruses could cause cancer, and they discovered a cancer-causing virus, which they named polyoma, which flew open the floodgates of congressional funding and led to the categorization of all these monkey viruses that we're talking about, which is how they finally figured out that the virus in question, polyoma, was this de facto same thing as SV40, and SV40 came from the rhesus monkey, and it was the rhesus monkey that used, they cut out the kidneys of the rhesus monkey to grow the polio vaccine, and then they finally found SV40 in the polio vaccine in about 200 million doses of it. And they made this discovery in 1959, and they kept, but they still had polio vaccine on the shelves, and for the next 3 or 4 years, they continued to release contaminated polio vaccine with the full knowledge that they were doing it, because they couldn't tell people why they would suddenly stop and take it off the shelves.
Polyoma, by the way, the name refers to the fact that this virus caused multiple cancers in multiple species. And again, it was virtually identical to the SV40, the focal point of the main element of our discussion in this program. Doctors Stewart and Eddy were also associates of Dr. Mary Sherman, a remarkable figure and somebody who is something of a breach from this discussion of medical research to the frightening power politics that were going on in New Orleans involving Alton Ochsner and the soon-to-be-introduced David Ferry.
Well, Mary Sherman went to medical school at the University of Chicago with Sarah Stewart. They were good friends since the 1930s. And then Mary came down to New Orleans and started working for Alton Ochsner. I say on page one of the book that it is first and foremost an investigation into the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman. That is the that murder is the pivot point through which we the prism through which we start to see what was really going on.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the forensics and the remarkable physical damage that Dr. Mary Sherman suffered in connection with her murder, and we'll perhaps get into that inside, too. I want to note in passing that Dr. Alton Ochsner was himself a giant in the Chicago area medical field, and it was from the University of Chicago, a very prestigious institution, that Dr. Sherman hailed from, or from the which she hailed. David,
University of Chicago was also the home of Enrico Fermi, the father of nuclear energy.
And we're going to get into what I think you present as a very compelling hypothesis of a linear particle accelerator and research into mutating monkey viruses inside, too. Ed, let's just give we've got about 2 minutes left. Touch ever so briefly on David Ferry, then give us a pitch for Dr. Mary's monkey and Tron Day.
Well, first of all, David Ferry is a major character. I recommend everybody watch Oliver Stone's JFK movie to get a feel for who David Ferry is, because he's a central player in this whole intelligence community in New Orleans and has connections to the mafia. He's a defrocked priest, blah, 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 but he was a brilliant guy and is well known to have been doing some form of cancer experiments. It was Jim Garrison who made the discovery and announced it in a Playboy interview in 1967 that he had associated Dr. Mary Sherman, who had been murdered by then, with David Ferry, and raised the issue in response to a question about Jack Ruby dying of cancer. And so that's, you know, Ferry's another pivot point in this whole story, and I really recommend everybody look at Oliver Stone's movie to get a handle on him and some of the other players there.
Also, Jim Davies' book, Let Justice Be Done, and Jim DiEugenio's Destiny Betrayed will flesh that out. Oh, we've got about 20 seconds left. Tell us about Tron Day and where to get the book. Dr. Mary's Monkey.
You can always get it at any bookstore or on Amazon, but I have a website if you want an author-signed copy, and I have 2.5 hours of videos on the website, and that is simply called themonkeyvirus.com. That's monkeyvirus.com, or Dr. Mary's Monkey, but just spell out Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R, Mary's Monkey, .com, and I'll give an 800 number for Try and Day, too. That's 1-800-556-2012, and you can order it directly from them, but it won't be signed.
And that concludes side one of For the Record program number 644, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This has been recorded on August 10th of 2008. More with Ed Haslam in side two. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.